From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on Forum, Jessie Klein won an Emmy in 2015 for her work as the head writer of the popular comedy show Inside Amy Schumer. But while everyone else fled to the glamorous Emmy after parties, Klein found herself backstage pumping breast milk for her newborn. Her memoir, You'll Grow Out of It, looks at the challenges women face juggling family, work, and social conventions, and her struggles growing up as an awkward tomboy. Join us for Forum. It's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. We welcome Jessie Klein to this Forum Hour, the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning head writer and an executive producer of Inside Amy Schumer, which can be seen on Comedy Central, and which just received 4 Emmy nominations this past week. She's a native-born New Yorker. She's written for Saturday Night Live and Amazon show Transparent and was featured on The Moth, and she's done stand-up comedy and appears regularly on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And she recently published a collection of essays called You'll Grow Out of It. We welcome her to this Forum Hour. Glad to have you with us.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you.
Well, you know, let's talk about tomboys and tom mans first, because that's how you begin your book. And you say you were a tomboy and you write about that. And that's a kind of fascinating story in itself. But then you say at one point, the only invention I've ever come up with in my life is Tom Man. And that's not true. You write all this stuff, all this comedy stuff and all this original stuff.
Terms of phrases and things, I have a lot of I'm always very interested in inventors. I don't know. I write things. It feels different than inventing. But Tom Man, I do feel like maybe that's a thing I've invented. I haven't seen anyone else use that phrase. But I also could be wrong. So no, if I'm inadvertently stealing, I don't want a Melania. Anyone else who has used the phrase Tom Man?
No, Melania, almost something you're saying. I don't know, Melania, malign somebody else.
Melania.
Melania, yeah.
There we go. We just invented another thing.
That's it. It's called a neologism, in fact, for anybody who's interested in that kind of pedantry, which obviously I am. This is a book about a lot of personal stuff. I mean, you let it all hang out there. There's a lot about rejection by men. There's a lot about your vulnerability and your insecurities. And there's also even things like being heckled at Yale. I mean, what compelled you to put it all out there?
I guess there's two in terms of the book, and then there's me putting it all out there just sort of as I walk through life. If you're asking specifically about the book itself and that process.
It's a bit of the genesis of the book or what was behind it.
Yeah, the genesis of the book. I wish it was like a more glamorous authorial story, but I was unemployed and we had just finished shooting the first season of Inside Amy Schumer, but it hadn't aired and we didn't know if we'd be picked up or how it would be received. And statistically in television, very often when you work on a new show, there's a good chance that when you walk out of the office on the last day of shooting, you might not be walking back in. So I didn't have a job and I didn't know what I was going to do. I was really kind of lost for a moment. And my manager said, I have a book agent you should meet. And it's a gentleman named David Kuhn, who had read a few essays I'd written over the years, one about going to my sister's wedding at Disney World, which is a story I told for The Moth as well. And we had lunch and he said, I think you should write a book. And I said, really? I've never thought that. And he gave me a structure to create a proposal where he just said, I want you to write a story a week and send it to me. And I, again, had nothing else going on. And it felt like as interesting a life raft as I had to cling to at the time. And once I got started, I really enjoyed writing.
Thought your calling was as a stand-up comic, didn't you?
It's interesting that you say calling. I think my calling has always been a little fuzzy to me and is maybe only coming a little bit into focus now. I think it's important to say that because I always, as someone who felt like my calling was murky, I'm always interested when other people talk about their callings being a little murky.
I think you use the word, though, in the book, if I'm not mistaken, about wanting to find your calling through stand-up comedy.
Yeah, no, I always felt called. I wanted to do stand-up. I don't think I ever I don't think I ever thought I would become a famous stand-up comedian, and I was correct. I did not become a famous stand-up comedian, but I did. I just felt compelled to try it, and I did find my voice through stand-up comedy, I believe, by doing that process, and I got okay at it.
Yeah, I've seen some of your work, and it is. I think you may be being modest.
Oh, thank you.
And also, your writing. I mean, I gave you a compliment before you went on the air here that others have given you. The writing is reminiscent of some of Nora Ephron, somebody I adored. And the fact is that she's become a very important person to you as a writer. And what was also fascinating to me, again, in this gender realm was that the early idols and, shall we say, models for you were mainly men, including a male horse.
He's referring to the Black Stallion.
Yes.
Not just like a male horse I personally knew in my neighborhood.
No, but you write about Groucho Marx. You write about Daniel Stern on the Wonder Years. And the fact of the matter is that I noticed this trajectory that moved into a shift to women, like Joan Rivers, for example, and a number of other women who became very important.
Janine Garofalo was one. She was a big one for me. You know, I think probably, you know, there's probably a few Freudian type reasons that, as you were saying earlier, Adrienne Rich might express more articulately. I think for me, I loved Groucho Marx was sort of the first funny thing I loved. I think maybe the reason I wasn't drawn to more female comedians as a really young person talking about being like, you know, 15 and under, was that there weren't really very many. There are so many more women doing comedy now. I mean, I'm about to turn 41. I've been saying I'm 40. I am 40, but I realize the clock is ticking on I'm 40. But yeah, when I was really young, when I was in elementary school, there were so few female stand-ups that were famous.
It was mainly Phyllis Diller when I was growing up.
I have met Phyllis Diller, and that was a big deal.
I interviewed Phyllis Diller.
Oh, loved her. She had on a huge diamond. When I met her, she had on a huge diamond pendant in the shape of the letter P that I think if she'd fallen in the water, she would have sank like a stone. But yeah, I once I saw women doing stand-up, which happened when my parents got cable when I was in high school, I just saw, oh, women do this too. And I think particularly at that time, women's, not that it's always this way, but the women's stand-ups I saw were doing more of a storytelling kind of stand-up.
Joan Rivers really broke all, I mean, and then even later
absolutely.
On, she... Remember, by the way, just anecdotally, when I interviewed her, that film was out about her. And,
yes,
piece of there was a huge line of women who bowed down to her as she left. So it's not just the comedians who were influenced by her. I must confess also in reading your work, I thought of a Joan Rivers joke that goes way back where she talked about, she said, you know, men can go out and have as much sex as they want with as many people as they want, but a girl makes 17, 18 mistakes, she's a tramp.
Great joke.
It's a whole different meaning now, though. You know?
Absolutely. I got asked to – I did an event in Chicago the other day, which was super, super fun. And I was doing a Q&A with an audience afterwards, and there was a gentleman there who was asking me a question about Amy Schumer. And his question was to the effect of, well, Amy Schumer – he's like, I like her. She's no choir girl. She seems like she likes sex a lot. And I, you know, he's like, and is that real or is that her persona? And I had so many problems with every aspect of the premise of his question, which I tried to point out gently but forcefully enough. Yes, there's still a lot of double standards about the way women and sex are viewed.
Well, you write very openly about sex, and you also write openly with – we had asked Polly on yesterday and talked about, you know, her
– love her.
Ease with profanity. And you're a big drinker, and not only that, but I have to add – when you write about porn, it's a – I mean, you may have moved into a different realm. Well, you say you use porn like men use porn.
Well – I don't know that I use porn. I guess we were all using porn for one headlining reason, but I think in the porn chapter I talk about I did a thing last night where someone was talking about, is there anything that's embarrassing about the book? And I think people sometimes expect me to say that the porn chapter is embarrassing, and admitting that I do occasionally watch porn. And I think I am not embarrassed at all by admitting that I watch porn. I kind of think most people at this point are occasionally looking at porn. I also talk about how in our society, I feel like it's almost difficult to not see porn. I mean, you Google something the wrong way and
it's ubiquitous.
It can, yeah, it's like falling under a badly stacked bookshelf. You'll just be buried. The thing that is embarrassing to me about my porn chapter is that I feel like the porn, as I describe in the book, the porn that I like to watch is so sweet and ridiculous. Like, I want to see two people in love just sort of gently having normal
sex. Tender porn
just,
out there?
Yeah, just
sweet sentimental.
There's very little of it.
Like oxymoron.
Yeah, just someone gently touching someone's cheek with their hand. It's very hard for me to find the porn that I can handle. Most of it seems pretty rough. So on that level, when you see what's available to watch on porn and you say, am I using porn the way men do? I'm not looking at a lot of the porn that I think a lot of guys are watching.
Well, you wrote this mostly while you were pregnant. I'm not sure if that figures into this. And I had a funny question, maybe a little bit offbeat question, but I know someone who will remain unnamed who's a famous woman writer, and she wrote novels, but she also wrote memoirs. Mm-hmm. And she said, and you have a son, and as her son started growing up and became curious about her writing, it was put in a whole different perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, the book did span. I started the book before I was pregnant, and I finished the book after my son was born, which is probably proof of what an incredibly slow writer I am. But it would occasionally cross my mind, oh, one day my child will read this, and how am I going to feel about that? But I have to say, I didn't want to feel too differently about him reading it versus any human being reading it. I don't ever want to be mean. I don't want to be a source of poison in the world to anybody. I kind of just want to be honest.
Well, you are. I mean, I think you in fact, what comes across in the book is a tremendous value that you place on authenticity and on being open and honest about your emotions. And this comes into your comedy, too, if I may say so. I thought maybe our listeners, many have heard this because this has been viral for a long time. But I think you were the brains behind this. It's something called The Last Effable Day.
Yes.
And it features it's a popular scene from Inside Amy Schumer. Some of you may, in fact, have heard it, seen it. Amy stumbles upon three famous actresses, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Patricia Arquette, and Tina Fey. They're having a picnic in the park, and they say they're celebrating Julia's last bleepable day. You know, we have to conform to the FCC regulations here. Basically, when she's no longer cast in roles as a sexy woman, Amy asks them to explain. Cut to.
Well, I mean, how do you know? Who tells you?
Nobody really overtly tells you, but there are signs. How Sally Field was Tom Hanks' love interest in Punchline, and then, 20 minutes later, she was his mom. And Forrest Gump.
Or you might get offered a rom-com with Jack Nicholson where you're competing with another woman. Or I just had an audition for Mrs. Claus.
You're kidding me.
I read for that part.
I read for that too.
You did?
Yes.
Hey, who got that?
J-Lo.
Oh, she'll be good.
She's going to be really good.
Really good. Mm. Or you go to a movie set, you go to wardrobe, mm-hmm. and the only thing they have for you to wear are long sweaters, cover you up head to toe kind of thing.
Right, or the poster for your movie is just like a picture of a kitchen.
Yeah, with these very uplifting and yet vague titles like Whatever It Takes or She Means Well, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm.
Another common sign is when they start remaking your best movies with younger actresses. I guess they're remaking Boyhood with Selena Gomez at my part.
Mm-hmm. That's going to make a lot of money.
Still holds up for you. She's laughing. I always love it when people hear their own work and it's funny and they laugh.
Part of what's enjoyable is that I think throughout that entire clip, almost every line, not just to avoid being labeled like such a narcissist about guffawing at my writing, almost every line in that clip, I think those women improvised, which is why it's still so fun for me to listen to, because what they ended up saying, there's a few things from the script that are in there, but I mean, you're on a set with those three ladies.
They're funny ladies.
They've got great suggestions.
And here you are, you say 41 years old. And you
almost
write,
41.
Almost 41.
40.
Well, okay, let's keep you at 40.
Give me my days that are left before my last special day.
And you can keep talking about being in your early 40s until you hit 46 even, because you're still in the half mark there.
Okay.
I give you a dispensation.
Okay, thank you.
But I'm also interested in the fact that you have a whole section in your book about being called ma'am. And
yes.
That gets crossing the Rubicon when suddenly they start calling you ma'am, isn't it?
Oh, that's a very graceful way of putting it. Ma'am is a real wake-up call. I think men and people from the South don't necessarily understand that reaction. I think the South is more attached to ma'am. Women are more into ma'am down there. But in general, it doesn't – sir is pretty cool. And you've been sir. Probably people started calling you sir at a certain point, maybe when you're in a restaurant as a kid, you know, once you're bigger.
Nobody called me sir as a kid.
Right? Well, you know, if you go as a, you know, once you're, someone calls you sir at a certain point.
Certain point.
And then
and it's the same point when you start realizing that the police all look younger than you. And they all look like
your
boys.
Your doctor might be about your age. Yeah. But then you're always going to be sir. You're sir until your last day. There's never a day where you are addressed with a term that lets you know what the person who's talking to you thinks about how old they think you are.
Well, you also write about aging, how you get more invisible when you get older. I mean, that's a serious topic.
Getting more invisible? Oh, for sure.
Yeah, but, you know, the whole ma'am thing, in fact, you mentioned it, I think, brings to mind Barbara Boxer, who was on the show recently, gave an exit interview, and we were talking about being, you know, the whole thing with
her
not being
called
senator. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's also these titles and what you do with titles. You know, I've got a few, and so, you know, people say, what do you want to be called? And, you know, you want to be called Michael? Mike? That's your husband's name, right?
Yes.
Professor, talk show host,
right.
You know, I mean, to be a comedy writer, though, I mean, you have the title now of executive producer as well. So that puts you, I mean, these titles and things like being called ma'am and sir put you in terms of your own self-identity in a whole different realm, don't they?
Yeah, I think probably we all, yeah, as we move through life, there's a ton of titles and labels that we suddenly find ourselves
Writer Jesse Klein. Stand-up comic Jesse Klein. Emmy award-winning Jesse Klein.
Terrible cook Jesse Klein.
Why is that?
Oh, really bad. Not good at it. Executive producer is a good one. I like that one. Ma'am, I don't love as much. I wish there was just, I don't see why we can't just be one thing the way men are one thing with sir.
Well, you have many things, obviously. What do you like writing for print? You like writing for comedy? You like stand-up? I mean, where does the hierarchy go?
A hierarchy.
Is there a hierarchy?
I don't know that there is a hierarchy. I think in the last few years, it's not so much one form over another as much as the thing I feel luckiest and most privileged about is, you know, my family, there's no one in entertainment. I came from, you know, a relatively humble economic background. I love my parents, and they're very intellectual, and I have a great relationship with them. But the point being, I would never have imagined I would be making my living as a comedy writer, and that feels so unbelievable to me. I feel, to me, the hierarchy is that I get to do a thing I love with people I like.
Well, you write about this isn't in the book, I think, but it's from an essay you did about going to Saturday Night Live the first time. And, you know, there you are with Lorne Michaels and with all these people that you kind of grew up with and everything. And the feeling was just staggering. It was overwhelming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did one season at SNL, and I grew up, you know, I used to talk about Groucho, but then, you know, at a certain point, SNL became the thing in my head. I was addicted to that show. I was obsessed with it, like many other people who go into comedy. It was, you know, hugely influential. And yeah, again, as I was just saying, never would have imagined I'd end up there. And the first night that the first Saturday night you have there, you eat your dinner in the commissary during rehearsal, and there's monitors everywhere, and the band starts to play that intro music because they're running the show. And to be in that room and hear the band playing the opening music that you've been hearing your whole life is surreal, to say the very least.
Well, your comedy writing is, of course, what many have appreciated and have loved. I thought we'd hear another popular sketch from the show that you're so involved in all these years. Actually, Jesse had a talk Amy Schumer into doing the show, wasn't she? Didn't want it. She wanted to do a kind of a talk show, and you said, "No, we got to do Louis, like Louis C.K."
It was something like that. She, I mean, Amy has been an incredible stand-up for a long time, and I met her doing stand-up just kind of around, and we hit it off, and we were, you know, friendly and always enjoyed running into each other. And then she got offered a pilot from Comedy Central, and not just a script, but they had promised to make something with her, which I think she didn't necessarily realize at the time is really pretty rare. And I think, yeah, there had sort of been this maybe generated by the network a little bit, this idea that, oh, you could do sort of just some kind of a talk showy format type thing. And I always feel bad that the story has become this. I mean, she probably would have done a great talk show, and maybe one day she still will. We went and got drunk, and she talked about how what she really wanted to do was act. And I was like, well, if you want to act, it seems like maybe do something where you can act. That was my big, brilliant innovation. I listened to what she wanted to do.
So many of these comics really want to be actors, I've noticed, as interviewing them. In fact, Joan Rivers, of course, loved acting and wanted to act
yes.
more than anything. But here's a sketch from the show Inside Amy Schumer. A number of famous actors reenact a scene from the movie 12 Angry Men, which many listeners probably remember who are old-timers. That was a Henry Fonda film from 1957 where jurors argued over whether a young man was guilty for murder. And in this version, also filmed in black and white, the men argue over whether Amy Schumer is hot enough to be on TV. They've got actors like Paul Giamatti and Mad Men's Vincent Kartheiser. They play the jurors. Jeff Goldblum speaks first.
Hey, let's take another vote. If anybody thinks that Amy Schumer shouldn't be on the TV because she's not hot enough for whatever reason, raise your hands. And those who think that she is hot enough?
You're on board with the toad now? Has the world gone mad? This girl thinks she deserves to be on camera? She's not a 10!
Maybe you're not a 10 either.
You bad!
You know what I was, when I heard that again this morning, I was thinking about last night. I don't know if you saw any of the Republican National Convention, but Chris Christie was saying, let's try Hillary Clinton for this and try her for that and so forth. It was like a prosecution. And you get into a lot of really feminist issues. I mean, a lot of people would say this was directed against Hillary Clinton, perhaps because she was a woman, perhaps not, because she was Secretary of State and so forth. You get into all those murky kinds of things.
Yes.
Are you backing her, by the way? You like her?
I'm with her very strongly.
Just want to get you on the record for that.
Yes.
And we're going to get our listeners involved in this as well. And on the record, let me invite you to join our program. We're talking, of course, with Jesse Klein. Her new book is called, she's a writer and executive producer for Comedy Central Inside Amy Schumer. It's called You'll Grow Out of It. And you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Welcome to our phone lines, 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum, and you can also go to our Facebook page. Feel free to join the conversation. Like to hear from you, your thoughts, your questions, your comments. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Jesse Klein, who is head writer and executive producer for Comedy Central Inside Amy Schumer, and author of an essay collection called You'll Grow Out of It. And she's also written for the Amazon show Transparent and for Saturday Night Live. And she has been a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And she'll be speaking tonight here in San Francisco at Book Passage at the Ferry Building at 6 p.m. So you can actually meet her, and you can meet her by joining us. In fact, if you have questions for her about how she comes up with sketches for Inside Amy Schumer or about her career path in comedy writing and stand-up, or for that matter, about some of the issues that we've been raising here about, what we could call sexual politics.
Fair enough.
Kate Millett term. give us a call, 866-733-6786, and you can join us at that number. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And let me go back to the clip we just heard before we went into that break.
Okay.
It's kind of bold to do on TV.
I have to say the 12 Angry Men, the full episode title was 12 Angry Men Inside Amy Schumer. And yeah, that one felt incredibly special the minute we started shooting it. And it was definitely a group effort in terms of getting all of the actors that we got. The day that we shot it, so it was the full 21 minutes basically. It was just that doing kind of this little encapsulation of the movie. And we usually shoot all over New York, but when we for a set, we shoot at the studio in New York City in, I believe, in Greenpoint, that used to be a porn studio in the 70s, and you can feel that it used
here
to be
you
a
are
porn
again associated
studio.
With porn.
I keep bringing it back. But that is where we shoot, so it's a little dingy. It's not glamorous. It's still a little gross. And there was a nor'easter that morning, and all of the actors were about 3 hours late due to traffic and weather. And we were just like, oh, is this going to work? And it was incredible. We had these Oscar winners, Golden Globe nominees, just this incredible level of talent, and including Amy in that, obviously. And
we've been very fortunate of the talent you've been able to get.
Well, we were behind all day long. You know, TV days are long, and we had to go into overtime. We stayed till like 1 or 2 in the morning, and all of the actors involved were just so on board. And I think as we were shooting it, everyone realized this is kind of like a special thing that we're doing. It felt... And when we saw the final result, we were really pleased with how it came out.
I'm going to hear another audio clip and go to our callers. But before we do that, you're in New York now, or you're in L.A.?
I'm in L.A.
You're in L.A. Because in your book, you write about, you know, missing New York and wanting to go back to New York. And there's something that kind of piqued my interest that you didn't go into. You said when you heard guys in the gym talking about karma, that was kind of... a revelatory moment for you. You realize you had to go back to New York.
Yeah, I mean, I do go back and forth. I think there was a moment at a Crunch gym. Yeah, I heard it was kind of that Jeff Goldblum moment in Annie Hall, where it's just that one line that he had as a young actor. It's like, I forgot my mantra. It was kind of that. I was like, oh, I got to get out of here.
Do you have that whole frame of reference in your head? You know, when you think of comic lines, you think of comic lines that have stayed in your consciousness?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I have a few that are probably, you know, I don't know how many are more obscure. I mean, everything in Annie Hall is pretty memorable.
And I want to ask you about a couple of other things that you write about before we get to our callers here, because you left me kind of up in the air about some things.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if this is intentional now, but you talk about having female trouble when you were in high school before you went to college.
Uh-huh.
And then you were, in fact, thinking you were going to die, but you don't say what that was, or I assume that came out okay, right?
First of all, I love that you're using the phrase female trouble. that feels kind of perfectly. That's very Nora Ephron, some female trouble. I think in the book I kind of, maybe I was too oblique about it, but the female trouble was really kind of more just psychological.
Okay.
It's kind of in that horrible tradition of hysteria.
You thought you were going to die.
I thought I was going to die. Yeah, I was having a weird, for anyone who's like, what are they talking about? I've always been a very anxious person who has gone through a variety of sort of depressive episodes throughout my life. And I think, I don't know how much of that is just the Jewish condition, my own personal stuff. But yeah, I think I had these periods of anxiety that very often presented themselves as physical maladies.
But you were lucky in that you found
I was fine.
Well, no, not that you were healthy and you were okay. That may have been psychosomatic, but you found a really good therapist named Connie, and there's a real tribute to her in the book too. But I also want to get into a little bit of the experience you had with a CAD. I never found out if he gave you an STD.
Oh, yes, you did. I told you he didn't. No, I did not. I was very lucky. Wait, I feel like you seem to have taken a bathroom break at all the exact moments in the book where I tell you if I have a disease or not.
I didn't even see that in the. And I do. You know,
no.
A close reading.
Oh, it's
obviously
Totally fine. No. I did not get an STD from the CAD. And in fairness to the CAD, he did not have an STD, at least in terms of the condition I talk about in the book, he did not have an STD either. It was a scare. It was something else. It was a he had an allergic reaction to a piece of clothing.
Well, you've written STD scares on your show, right?
Yeah, we did. I wrote a sketch where Amy played someone having a herpes scare and starts bargaining with God, who is played by Paul Giamatti.
And the guy who you wanted to smear the cake frosting on?
onto the walls of his apartment, not on him.
On this apartment.
Those would be very different emotions, I think.
Yeah, thank you for that distinction. I misspoke there. It was on the apartment. But there was a sense of, obviously jealousy, and he had left you for another woman, and it was... All that painful stuff.
Yeah, I was in my 20s, and I wrote a chapter about I was with a college boyfriend for a long time after we graduated, and he was my first boyfriend. And as first boyfriends from college, those kinds of relationships often, I think, come to kind of a car crash style endings, and that one definitely did. And yeah, I had a tremendous jealous episode. It's really one of the most horrible feelings to feel, I think, jealousy. It's awful.
In fact, that's why they call it the green monster. there's also a passage in your book where you're writing about a guy as being a narcissist, and it struck me, just interestingly enough, a woman friend who was talking about how a lot of women talk about men as being narcissists after the men abandon them or break up with them, or you even write about the "I'm not just not into you anymore," that kind of stuff, and
right.
So forth. But he really was a narcissist.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point here. We actually did a little sketch about that phenomenon on Inside Amy Schumer this season, of women kind of assigning these floating mental pathologies to men who just have dumped them. It's like, oh, what a bipolar maniac. And it's like, no, maybe it just was a guy who you shouldn't have dated and he didn't like you. But I will say I looked up what actual classical narcissism is considered, and I felt like he had some symptoms, but I'm not a doctor. I actually did.
We're going to go to one other clip, and then okay. I promise I'm going to go to callers. We thought maybe you could hear a sketch from Inside Amy Schumer, you being our listeners again. Amy goes shopping for a size 12 shirt at a nice clothing store, but she runs into some resistance from the saleswoman.
Can I help you find something?
Do you have this in a larger size?
Have what in what?
This shirt in a larger size.
Have you checked under the table?
These are even smaller.
Could you keep your voice down? You're scaring the thinner customers.
Oh, sorry.
Can I help you find something else? Maybe some jewelry?
No, I just need just this in a size 12.
Like a UK 12, which is a US 8, or like a Japanese 12, which is an American toddler 3.
Is that true? No, I just this in a 12, a US 12.
I could call the Midwest for you.
All right, now that wasn't your baby, right? But that deals with a lot of the themes of the show.
Yes, that sketch in particular was written by a very brilliant writer named Tammy Sager. But we chipped in. It's such a great sketch, and I think a lot of women probably have had that experience. I've been having it a ton recently myself, because I had a baby, and I'm nowhere near the weight I was before. And yeah, it's pretty shocking how often you go into a store and you don't think of yourself even, or I mean, no judgments of anyone of any size. I don't think of myself as someone who's particularly huge in any way. And yet it seems like somehow my body has crossed the threshold into it's sometimes they don't make my size.
Wasn't there a sketch, in fact, where you're trying to get down to a size 1 and there's all this sales lady talk about you look great in that?
That was a sketch that I wrote and that I was in, called New Body. And it was just about shopping for, the horrible goal is size 0, which is, I don't think men have that and they never would.
And
there's no size 0 for dudes.
No.
No, you wouldn't dream of such a thing.
I would not. And after episode, when you talk about having a baby and all that, I would recommend the book just for any women who are pregnant or having a baby and everything, just because the epidural stuff itself is worth and important to read about.
Thank you.
And so is bringing our callers in. Let me do that now. Let me get Annie on here first. Annie, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Annie.
So my question has to do with looking at other material while you're writing. So
yes.
When you're writing, and let's say that you're writing something that's more topical, do you put your blinders on and not watch SNL and not read The Onion or any other sources of comedy? Do you look at that as for inspiration, or do you try not to plagiarize?
Plagiarism itself, very topical right now. We definitely can't ever put blinders on because for sure we don't want to be putting on anything that anyone else is doing. So I don't know that we're – I mean, we all love to watch comedy, and so we are watching other shows. But we're not – I wouldn't say we're watching them for inspiration, but no matter what we come up with, we have a team of people who then really have to comb through – not just what's currently on, but things that have been done in the past to make sure that it's in no way similar. Because, and it's a bummer because very often there is kind of collective thinking and someone will have written a sketch that we're like, ooh, that's super original. And then we go look on YouTube and, you know, someone else has done it or SNL is on every week and they may have done something in the vein of what we were thinking of doing. So we just try to be really careful to not... not have anything on that's similar to what other people are doing.
Annie, we thank you for the call. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. Let me go to some of the emails. Listener writes, what does Jesse Klein think about the idea one hears from time to time that pretty women can't be funny because they haven't had to suffer in life and comedy springs from suffering and the misery it engenders?
I don't believe that pretty women can't be funny. I think all people of all attractiveness levels are capable of being very funny. I think there is something to suffering and comedy, and there's a connection there. I think any pretty person would tell you that there's tons of different ways to suffer, and whether there's suffering because you're not pretty, and then there's suffering because you're too pretty. There's a lot of suffering out there.
There are also a lot of different types of pretty women, as you point out, but you get on a dichotomy of famous poodle women and wolf women. let me just give a sample of who the poodle women are and then who the wolf women are, and then you can go into
I'll contextualize.
Explanation. Exactly. Famous poodle women, Angelina Jolie, Keira Knightley, Charlize Theron, Kate Moss, Nigella Lawson. Famous wolf women, Sandra Bullock, Helena Bonham Carter, Tina Fey, Jennifer Aniston. Okay, what do you mean?
Okay. I want to be very clear. It's so funny that this has become something people talk about. My poodle wolf metaphor is kind of more about the effortlessness of femininity and how it seems to me that some women find just their connection to sort of the cultural norms of femininity very easy to pull off, and it seems like for some women it's more work. And to me, and so I came the poodle wolf thing kind of came out of being at SNL one night, and me and another writer named Emily were watching Angelina Jolie get interviewed by Charlie Rose, and it was 3 a.m. and we were both not in our best states, and we just were looking at Angelina, and my friend said, are we even the same species as her? Because it doesn't feel like we are. And I said, well, it's the way like a poodle and a wolf are technically kind of both in the dog family, but they don't look anything alike. And so, yeah, but to be clear, it's not about one being attractive and the other not. Poodles and wolves can both be beautiful. I feel like a wolf insofar as for me to get dressed up, put makeup on, try to look like a stereotypically sort of attractive person per our American standard it's like moving an armoire. I can't.
But you're still maybe a wolf in sheep's clothing or something like that.
There are wolves in poodle clothing for sure. But again, both can be beautiful. It's not a value of attractiveness. It's about, I guess, how easy you find it to be a girl as defined by the country we live in.
And you tried on 100 wedding dresses, though.
I did try on 100 wedding dresses. It's so embarrassing. That's way more embarrassing than anything I could say about my porn habits.
Let me bring another caller on here. And Roger's joining us. Roger, you're on the air.
Yes. A couple of questions kind of along the same line. Somebody like Robin Williams can pretty much do anything, anywhere, at any time, and it's funny. Can you comment on the difference between someone like that and female comedians today? And then my last question is, can you pick five favorite comedians of all time?
Ooh, I feel like those are those are two very different questions. I'm not quite sure about the relationship between Robin Williams and female comedians. I love Robin Williams and was very saddened by his passing. And he certainly was very funny. And there are tons of female comedians that I also think are very funny. I'm not quite sure about what distinction is being asked about.
Robin Williams was kind of manic, you know, when he was performing always and highly
yes.
energetic and just kind of a comic genius. Not kind of, he was a comic genius.
Yes.
If you met him personally, he was a very soft-spoken and self-effacing and self-conscious man.
That's what I've always heard about him. Never the twain would meet. Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, as a performer, you're on a different kind of fuel system almost, really, or batteries that are different completely, aren't they?
Well, I think for sure if you are performing and the spotlight is on you, you're trying to kind of entertain. And for me, that muscle is not necessarily the same muscle I always want to be working when I'm having coffee with a friend. And it's not the muscle that I necessarily worked while I was writing the book either. I think a lot of comedians, men and women alike, are definitely one way on stage and then might be, you know, everyone's a human being. Everybody needs kind of quiet moments and deeper moments and sad moments.
There's a listener named Charity who writes, just finished your book last night. Great read. My 14-year-old daughter is on the poodle and wolf chapter and was concerned that you have internalized misogyny. Yikes. Let me read the rest of hers, and then we had a great conversation, and the upshot was, this is our struggle as women, to reconcile what we think we should be as opposed to what we really are. Thanks for your voice. That's at the heart of your book, really.
Yeah. And thank you to whoever wrote that in, and I'm so glad I could help spawn a conversation between a mother and a daughter like that. I think that is very much what the book is about. I'm a feminist, and a lot of the book is about looking at the things that it seems like women are expected to do and feeling like, oh, that is a ton of nonsense. Oh, I have to weigh this. I have to not eat that. I have to be quiet. I don't want to do those things. And then there's the side of things where it's like, oh, yeah, I want to be desirable. Oh, that face cream costs $300, but it's supposed to make me look younger and I know better, but maybe I'll splurge and buy it. I think we're all a little torn on that stuff.
Well, you're right about shopping for underwear, for example, and you say there's the sense to be desired, and it means to be sometimes inspiring lust. Lust, too, is a jewel. Adrian Rich. There I go again.
There you go.
Yeah. But here's a question from a listener named Joseph who says, is Ms. more acceptable than ma'am?
I don't have, you know, and I'm only speaking personally, so I can't speak for other women. I don't mind Ms. at all. Ms. is fine by me.
Roger wanted to know your top five comics. That may be a difficult question to answer.
It is tough because there are just so many comedians I love.
And you don't want to leave people out.
I don't want to leave people out. I mean, the ones I like, well, obviously Amy Schumer, Louis C.K., Chris Rock, Jeanine Garofalo. Oh, gosh. There are so many.
You don't hear much from Garofalo anymore.
I mean, she's just one of my favorite stand-ups of all time.
And you mentioned Joan Rivers.
We are in a little bit of a golden age of stand-up. There are so many great stand-up comedians.
Serious question from a listener who wants to know if you have any thoughts on actress Leslie Jones leaving Twitter because of the abuse she suffered, or thoughts on the general animosity to the remake.
Oh, that's a great question.
Ghostbusters being remade.
Yes. I was just talking about this yesterday. I mean, there's two separate things going on there. I mean, what happened with Leslie Jones on Twitter is really a very, very disturbing ugly phenomenon.
A lot of vicious, misogynistic trolls out there.
That was misogyny and racism. Yeah. That was appalling. And I think Twitter has to do a much better job of kind of dealing with people who are
They're suspending these people. Supposedly, they can just open another account.
I mean, people are making death threats and things like that. You have to deal with it. In terms of the misogyny about Ghostbusters,
I should mention she is an African American actress.
Yes, and she's on SNL and she's hilarious. I love Leslie Jones. And in terms of the misogyny about Ghostbusters, I think it is it's outrageous, and it's almost. Excuse me. I was talking to Lindy West, who's a feminist writer and a comedian who's written a lot about this. And she talks about how when misogynists come out of the woodwork, it is almost like in some ways when you've been a feminist who's talking about how much misogyny there is. And then these misogynists come out and are like, you know, F you. There's no such thing as misogyny. And by the way, I'm going to rape and kill you for saying that misogyny exists. And how dare you remake Ghostbusters? You're like, well, you've just made my point. And she kind of had this beautiful way of putting it, that there's like this army of people producing evidence for you all the time of just how bad things are. And whatever else you might think about Hillary Clinton as a candidate, I strongly support her. It seems to me there's an enormous amount of criticism that she endures purely because she is a woman. And again, I'm separating that from whatever other legitimate criticism anyone might have. But it seems worth examining how much of it is just, how dare you want to be president of the United States?
Well,
you're a woman.
Same thing with Barack Obama being a black man.
Exactly. Well,
and we're going to take
similar
more of our
but different, yeah.
Calls from, here's a caller from Boston. Michael, join us. Hi.
Yes, I think Ms. Klein has it right about the sort of smiling tolerance of a girl being a tomboy. I think there's actually a kind of a demeaning quality to it in that sort of like, oh, look, she's trying to be above her station by trying to be like a boy. And by contrast, masculinity is so valued that if you're male and around the same age and you don't act masculine enough, they send in guys to beat you every day and to slash up all your stuff.
I think definitely now that I have a baby, I have a baby boy, and I shop for little kids things for baby stuff. I am just constantly, I guess I knew it, but wasn't so in it before, of the gender splitting of clothes and toys and just everything. The pink-blue split is just the beginning.
But he's right. Tomboys are considered sort of cute and they're nurtured and all that, whereas if a boy is effeminate, for example, or is a tom girl, he's a sissy and he's ridiculed and he's often even tormented.
Yeah, absolutely. I think to the degree that there is a reluctant sort of condescending tolerance of tomboys, absolutely boys acting feminine is very threatening to people for a lot of different reasons, and it's terrible. And I think it's part. I mean, there's a million reasons, obviously, that we can't cover. But I think femininity. I think a lot of people find femininity very dangerous.
Let me thank the caller for that, and we'll go next to you, Martin. Thanks for waiting. You're on with us.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I love Amy Schumer, and I thought the 12 Angry Men, but do you take a specific slant on self-deprecation for her in terms of viewing her? Do you dissect, okay, she's got blonde hair, you know, she's this size, you know, she wears this size shoes. Do you take that and run, you know, with that material specifically?
Sorry, and you're just asking about in terms of, like, how comfortable we are with writing material for Amy that's self-deprecating?
Yes.
Yeah, Amy has such a strong voice, and I think self-deprecation can be really, really funny. And I think it only gets tricky with women insofar as, as in most aspects of life, women are dissected so much more for their appearance, and men are self-deprecating, and no one ever really kind of thinks twice about it. And as a female comedian, you want to be self-deprecating as much as anybody does to get a laugh. But very often you kind of feel something from the audience in terms of, well, are you allowed to be, are you too pretty to be self-deprecating? Are you not attractive enough to be self-deprecating? I'm talking about women in general here. And not just
I remember Amy Schumer on Jon Stewart once said, there was a picture of her with, I guess, somebody who was off, alleged her BFF, Jennifer Lawrence. And she said, she looked at the picture and she kind of recoiled and said, I look like Alfred Hitchcock. And it's a funny line.
Yeah, but it's a very funny line. Yeah, I think we all have those feelings. And yeah, that's a hilarious joke. I didn't know she said she looked like Alfred Hitchcock. Yeah, I think, you know, speaking for myself, I like to do self-deprecating comedy as well. I do sometimes, as a woman, feel like I need to tread or at least think maybe a little bit more carefully about it, because I just think the audiences, particularly the male audiences, feelings about seeing a woman self-deprecate are more complicated.
What's next for you? We got seconds left.
I don't know right now. I'm just trying to get through this day.
Well, good luck with that and with the days to come. And it's been a pleasure having
Thank
you on.
Thank you. Likewise. Thanks for
We've
having
been talking
me.
With Jesse Klein, head writer and executive producer of Inside Amy Schumer, the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning show on Comedy Central. Her new book is You'll Grow Out of It, and she'll be at Book Passage tonight at the Ferry Building at 6 o'clock. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irina Gucci, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we got online support from Amanda Font. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer, Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.